Good evening, everyone, and welcome to another event at the Commonwealth Club of California. You can hear our broadcast, of course, on the radio, and you can find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. Tonight, it's my honor to introduce you to our speaker, Timothy Ferris. Tim is a nationally and internationally well-known writer who has focused principally in the areas surrounding science, particularly physics, astrophysics, cosmology, and even a wonderful book about the contribution that amateur astronomers can make to the scientific field of astronomy called Seeing in the Dark. Tonight, we are here to hear Tim on a slightly different topic. The book is called Science of Liberty, Democracy, Reason, and the Laws of Nature. And what's different about this book is, first of all, it is about science, but it's not just about science. It's about the correlation, and really a causal correlation, between the evolution of scientific thinking and scientific discipline and the evolution of what Tim will define for you, but a very important term, of the liberal democracy. What I love about this book, and I've had a chance to read it, is that it doesn't take us just on a vertical exploration of this, of the disciplines of political science and physical science. It correlates horizontally the development of those two disciplines and shows how, while we want to put labels on things in our world in order to describe them, the world doesn't know that, and it allows concepts to evolve or co-evolve in parallel, and it's just we who have to try to name them. So without further ado, please let me introduce to you Timothy Ferris.
Thank you very much, Roy, for that kind introduction. And when some people, when they say they've read your book, mean they've read some of it, or the dust jacket flap copy. Roy, my impression is, will only say that when he's read a book two or three times. So he knows what he's talking about. And whereas I sort of struggle to try to remember everything that's in the book. The thesis of this book, as Roy indicated, is that science and liberalism are symbiotic. And I'd like to start by defining those two terms. So first, science. When I talk about science tonight and when I discuss it in The Science of Liberty, I have in mind what is sometimes called modern science, although I would encourage the view that science and liberalism are both terms that require no modifiers and are never made clearer by applying modifiers to them. There's only one kind of science worldwide. It's the only genuinely international community we have. There's no right-wing or left-wing science, no Western or Eastern science. It's either science or it's not. And in the book, I have not attempted to look into the very interesting question of why science arose when and where it did. It's sufficient for my thesis of a symbiotic relationship between science and liberalism simply to look at the way these two currents, very powerful currents in human thought, have co-evolved since science got going sometime in the 17th century. Now, the scientific method, and there is one, contrary to what some scholars have claimed, looks something like this, that you have an idea, but instead of being able to test that idea only by examining its internal logic, or by comparing it to other ideas, which were the two methods known to Aristotle and which he put forth, science invented a new method, which is to test the idea through experiment. Ideas which pass such tests might be accurate. Hence, all scientific knowledge technically is conditional. Ideas which fail may be abandoned or revised. And ideas which cannot be so tested are not scientific ideas. Doesn't mean they have no value in the world. It's just that they're not in the realm of science. So that's what I mean when I talk about science, this mechanism of having a hypothesis that's tested through experiment that has to be replicable by anybody else who can set up the same conditions, and is then either modified, discarded, or conditionally adopted on that basis. Now, let me give you an example. There are hundreds of such examples in the history of science. I'll just give you one. Paul Dirac, in 1928, wrote an equation that described the behavior of electrons. It's a beautiful piece of mathematics, and it's quite accurate in its depiction of electrons within its sphere. But the equations implied the existence of an antimatter counterpart to the electron. It's called now the positron. No one had ever heard of any such thing, and Dirac was a bit embarrassed by it. He downplayed it, but he couldn't get it out of the equation. Carl Anderson in 1932, without knowing about Dirac's equation, discovered the positron and thereby verified it. Hence, the Dirac equation of the electron was affirmed. And it's been affirmed ever since in thousands of other experiments. I mention this sort of thing just to make one ancillary point, which is that science hasn't just discovered a lot of things and vastly enhanced the dimensions of human knowledge. It's also established a new and considerably higher criterion for what constitutes a proof of something. And it's been necessary for other fields of endeavor to try to find ways to respond to this. The essence of this approach, therefore, is that science is experimental. It's not that it's rational. We read a lot about how the Enlightenment was about rationality. But rationality had been around for a long time, and rationality is far less powerful than science. You can reason your way into some pretty hideous conclusions, and unfortunately a lot of people have. So the point of science is not just reason, although that's an aspect of it. It's experiment. In my book, I describe an experiment one night when Tom Paine was visiting George Washington at a rented estate in New Jersey called Rocky Hill. They went out after dinner in a scow with torches to test their two competing hypotheses as to what it was that was causing flames to appear spontaneously over this river on occasion. No one really yet knew. Paine had the correct theory, and it survived the experiment. George Washington did not. A reviewer of the book recently pointed out that, to him, the astonishing thing about this story was that these two men went out on this expedition thoroughly knowing that one of them was going to be proved wrong, and that was just fine with both of them. After all, there was a truth out there, and they were going to figure out which one it was, and that was the direction they wanted to go. Washington always had a lot of scientific interests, although he dropped out of formal education at the age of 15, and Paine was so embroiled in science that he always felt it was his true calling and that politics was just a sideline for him. This critic reviewing the story said, "You will never hear the sentence, Sarah Palin went out on a boat to test her theory." And we'll come back to that at the end of my remarks. Liberalism, by liberalism I mean the original liberalism, the one enshrined in the English Bill of Rights of 1689 and the U.S. Bill of Rights of 1789, the theory that citizens ought to have equal rights under the law, that people should be maximally free to pursue their own interests, and that we should be very concerned about any organization, and the government is the most threatening of these, that has the power to abridge human liberties. This is sometimes in the U.S. called classical liberalism. I would suggest that we just restore it, the words to what they mean, call liberalism by that name, and call the American left by various names that the left has itself come up with, such as progressive. I would also suggest that we stop thinking about politics in terms of a one-dimensional left-right continuum. In science, you know, it happens all the time that you run into problems that don't make sense in a limited number of dimensions, and so you construct higher-dimensional phase spaces, as they're called, to try to clarify the situation. And I think we can do that in politics if we just add one more dimension to make a two-dimensional scheme. And there's one in the book. It's a kind of diamond, and it has the left and the right in their usual positions. Then it has liberalism at a third corner, and totalitarianism, which is the actual opposite of liberalism, at the fourth corner. And within an arena like this, and you might want to try constructing one yourself, you can, I think, see the play of political dynamics much more clearly. And one thing that emerges when you look at it in these terms is that you will see, for instance, that it is just as possible to be a liberal and have conservative views on many things as it is to be a liberal and have progressive views. At the same time, there are lots of progressives who aren't liberal at all, and there are lots of conservatives who aren't liberal at all. But it's no further from liberalism to progressivism or conservatism, same distance. It also solves this old riddle that used to trouble people as to why totalitarians are all more or less alike. A totalitarian philosophy that comes from the right is virtually indistinguishable from one that comes from the left. That's because they've converged down at a position opposite to that of liberalism. It also helps us understand, by the way, why in liberal societies like ours, classically liberal societies, you can have polite, interesting discourse between people who disagree a lot about public policy. We've always had this kind of terrible rancor that's currently near one of its peaks about differing political positions, but we've also always had a tradition of being able to talk to one another politely despite those differences. And the people who can do that and who want everybody to be able to do that are called liberals. Liberalism in action operates similarly to science. You have a theory such as the idea that ordinary people should be maximally free. You conduct an experiment. The United States is such an experiment. The United States was named by Thomas Paine, and who was a science writer, and conceived of as a scientific experiment. Jefferson, among the founders, particularly talked in these terms. If you look at Jefferson's second inaugural address, he says, "This experiment of ours with a free press has been sorely tested. Never has a political figure been so vehemently attacked in the press as I've been during the last 4 years. But not only has the Republic survived, my administration has survived, we even got reelected." So far the experiment continues to work. Many of the other founders use these terms as well. What the American system and other liberal democratic systems do is to incorporate experiment into the way they function so that every election is an experiment, every passage of law is an experiment. What they're not so good at yet is the analyzing the results part. So there's a tendency in all liberal governments to enact more laws and set up more programs than they really subsequently evaluate properly. And it's often very hard to get rid of programs that aren't working, because they have constituencies that benefit from them in one way or another. As a result of this, every liberal democracy in the world is growing as a share of the total wealth in that country. So even though the economies are growing, the share that's being claimed by the government in all these countries is increasing decade by decade. And that should be a concern to anyone other than an outright socialist, because that's a really big government. It does present a threat to one's liberties. That's not a conservative opinion, that's a liberal opinion. Now, how is science symbiotic with liberalism? Well, both are anti-authoritarian. Science has always been anti-authoritarian because experimental results have a tendency to disprove even great authorities, and that's built into science. All scientists, even the greatest ones, are wrong about some things, and yet there's never been a ceremony in any scientific society to strip off the epaulets from some scientist and send him or her out of the Church of Science, because there is no Church of Science, and if there were, being wrong would not disqualify you from it. It's understood in science that everybody, including the most respected people, will be wrong. And the same thing's understood in liberalism and incorporated into liberal democratic systems. One of the reasons that citizens in liberal democracies are able to abide by terrible, traumatic election results, where their tribe loses even though it won the majority of the votes through a Supreme Court decision, is that they know that in the long run it won't matter that much. that it's better to have a qualified president than an unqualified president, but we've had both kinds for centuries, and the republic is still here. Both science and liberalism are self-correcting systems. Liberalism through the methods I've been describing, and science through the fact that as long as science is an ongoing enterprise, you have young scientists coming up, who many of whom are eager to make a reputation by proving that their elders were wrong about something. This doesn't overturn science entirely. It doesn't overturn liberal democracies, but it's a good self-correcting, refreshing mix that goes on in both systems. They're both powerful. They're both social, and I should add that when I talk about science, I'm talking also about the science that, as we know it today and as we've known it for the last couple of centuries, a social construction that has professional scientists, laboratories, universities, refereed journals, scientific conferences, all of that. My book is not concerned with the issue of whether if you go back 800 years and you find a solitary scholar who did something that we today would consider scientific, whether that has to do with the thesis. I start the clock around about 1609 or so. And both liberalism and science require maximizing intellectual resources, which means public education. When John Locke was inventing liberalism, he wrote extensively about public education and did so in terms that sound very modern today. Locke had a very good, sensitive understanding of children and how they should be treated with respect and kindness. It's clear that science benefits this way because we need, in science, maximum brain power. Science, therefore, has certain liberal imperatives, such as not arbitrarily excluding people who can provide brain power on irrelevant bases, such as whether they're women. And I'm old enough to remember when the Princeton Physics Department, for instance, would simply not admit any women students. Well, you're not going to compete successfully like that very long, because that's half of all the people in the world. And so in liberalism, you have a similar injunction to maximize intellectual resources because people are going to vote, and you would prefer that they be educated and have a better sense of what's going on and be a little more invested in the country than that they be ignorant and alienated. Now, my book argues that science incited the Enlightenment, caused is perhaps not too strong a word, which in turn, everyone agrees, led to the Democratic Revolution that I'll be talking about here. When I was a student, we were taught that the Enlightenment came about because all these different philosophers started writing things that contributed to the Enlightenment. It was like crop circles. They just turned up overnight, and no one seemed to know why or where these books had come from. It seems to me that the question you want to ask is, what was new? And what was the new ingredient, the crystal dropped into the supersaturate that produced this sudden change that we call the Enlightenment? And to me, the one clear candidate for that is science. Starting around, say, 1605, when Francis Bacon began to glimpse the real power of induction and experiment and wrote influential books predicting that this system would trump the highly reasoned philosophical systems that had preceded it. 1609, Galileo published his telescopic observations and showing that just looking through the telescope could prove that ancient authorities, even Aristotle, were wrong about at least some things. An interesting sidelight to that is that the oldest surviving printed newspapers in Europe, which were published, that started in Germany, started in 1609, that same year. And they started because there was such inflamed public interest by Galileo's findings that people wanted to read more about science. And newspapers actually, in a sense, started to report science, of all things. They proved very popular in combination with coffee, which was just coming in from Turkey at that time. So you had a combination. You had a place to go, a coffee house, where you could read the papers and drink a cup of coffee, and turn around, talk to your neighbors about what you read in the papers. This combination proved seditious in every jurisdiction in which it was established. And leaders from Cairo to London attempted without success to make coffee houses illegal. 1687, Newton published his Principia, which changed the world by beginning to show the tremendous predictive power of science. And I would suggest that the Enlightenment, which is usually dated from the following year, the beginning of the Glorious Revolution, the established parliamentary authority in England, should instead be dated from the publication of the Principia in 1687. On down through, a lot of things happened, including Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations in 1776, which has had tremendous consequences, the American Declaration of Independence that same year, and the publication in 1859 of Darwin's Origin of Species, the impact of which on human thought will be, in my expectation at least, so great that we cannot even yet begin to understand the changes in our perception that the comprehension of how life evolved are going to bring about. So the term liberal democracy means a democracy. People vote to elect their leaders. And the liberal part is that, however, they are not free by a simple majority vote to abridge anybody's human rights. So the liberal part of liberal democracy is you've got human rights that aren't just subject to majority rule. And other than that, it's a democratic country. Now, one of the great successes, I want to talk a bit about the impact that this combination of liberal democracy and science has had on the world since their inception back in the 1600s, 1700s. And the first of those has been the spread of liberal democracy itself. Circa 1800, you had maybe three liberal democracies in the world, and that's if you don't count suffrage, if you're willing to put up with the suffrage barriers that only allow a minority of people to vote. By 1850, there were five. By 1900, around 13. 1950, there were 22 liberal democracies in the world. Today, there are 89. 46% of all human beings now live in liberal democracies, and it is the stated preference of the majority of the human species. I'll give you a recent example. A poll just released the other day of 2,000 Arab youths aged 18 to 24 interviewed at length in nine Middle Eastern nations showed that their top priority was living in a democracy. They didn't want to give up their culture. They didn't want to go someplace else. They wanted to have democracy there. And you get similar results when you poll anybody in the world who is not totally subjugated by a controlled press, a place like North Korea, where they just have no idea what's going on in the rest of the world. Now, in the books, I looked at the attainments of science and liberty in terms of three broad categories that it seemed to me everyone could agree are good things for people, and they are health, wealth, and happiness. So let me review with you a few points of just what's happened in the world since science and liberal democracy got going. Life expectancy at birth for all of humanity has doubled since the year 1800. 1800, half of the babies born would not live to see their 30th birthday. Today, that's 67 worldwide, more than doubled human lifespan in only 200 years. World population has increased by a factor of 10 from since 1700, from less than fewer than 700 million people to 6.7 billion today. Despite that increase, world food production has more than kept pace with the rising population. Food production just from 1961 to 2001 was up 52% per person worldwide despite the rapidly increasing population. So in terms of health, it's, of course, an unprecedented record. In terms of wealth, well, the world per capita GDP in 1800 was a little under $700 a year. The growth rate was 1%. So half of people in the world were making less than $700 a year in 1800. Today, that number is close to $7,000, another factor of 10 increase. And the growth rate averaged over enough time, so we're not looking at the recent recession, is about 3%. So the growth rate has approximately tripled. And these, by the way, are real numbers. There's a kind of cynical tradition that has tried to wave these away and claims that it's all just the sort of Bill Gates walks into a coffee shop and suddenly you're worth $1 billion. That doesn't work. Economists aren't that dumb. And you can look at it, for instance, in terms of quintiles, which is the customary way to divide up people into the top to bottom 20% at a time. All five of those quintiles have increased phenomenally in wealth over the period 1800 to the present. I might add that another widely discussed myth is that, well, yes, this was achieved, but it was achieved at the a cost of great inequality, growing global inequality. You'll find quoted in my book even the statement that appeared in one publication that the 9/11 attacks were the result of the growing global inequality caused by globalization. The problem is there isn't any such growing inequality, and you'll find the discussion of this in The Science of Liberty. I think we had a misapprehension based on the fact that when countries start to take off, when they drop their trade barriers and start to get involved in international trade, the economy starts to grow not a tenth of 1% or 1%, but 2 or 3 or 5 or 8% a year. Some people do get a whole lot wealthier in a short period of time than the rest, but that's not what holds up in the long term. In addition to these successes in health, wealth, happiness, I should mention. It's hard to measure happiness. One thing I did look at were literacy rates, because people all around the world agree that it's better to be able to read and write than not to be, that they feel better off, they feel more engaged there. It's a doorway to many kinds of happiness. In 1970, 63% of the adults in the world were literate. That was already a big achievement, a big advance over what we'd had before. 1985, that had gone from 63 to 73%, despite the growth in population, an increase of 10% overall in literacy. And today it's over 80%. Over 80% of the people worldwide, adults worldwide, are literate. There's also a thing called the United Nations Subjective Well-Being Index, which shows that as you make more money, you tend to get happier, up to about $15,000 a year. And after that, money doesn't buy happiness. Now, there have been some other accomplishments as well, and I'll just mention a couple of them because they're so startling. One was the abolition of the African slave trade, which went back more than 1,000 years. The growing sense of liberal demands for human rights and universal human rights showed up in things like the establishment in 1787 of the Society for the Abolition of the British Slave Trade in London. That was 1787. Other such as, organizations soon followed in France and in Holland. And it took less than a century for the African trade slave slave trade to be ended. It was just started out as small gatherings of people over tea and printing up pamphlets and so forth. But it began to show the power of a liberal democracy to identify. This was a big deal with powerful financial interests, but it was hideously wrong. And once people began to say it was hideously wrong, it didn't last a century. Peace. The world's much more peaceful than it used to be. Among ancient peoples, the death rate, about which a lot of study has been done, we now know something, was at least 50 times higher than it is in the world today. That means that the average member of, say, a Stone Age tribe, the sort of people celebrated in books like The Gentle Tassadae about the peace-loving but unfortunately non-existent Stone Age tribe described in that book, which remains in print in 3 editions, were more likely to die violently than someone living in Western Europe at the height of World War II. The world's a lot more peaceful place than it was before. And it's also more peaceful because liberal democracies very seldom make war against one another. So as liberal democracy spreads, which in response to the desire of people all over the world to have this form of government, a desire so powerful that even the Chinese Communist Party has now its official policy that China will one day become a liberal democracy, the world should also continue to become more peaceful. Women constitute the majority of U.S. university students today, and this year will become a majority of the American workforce for the first time. There's still a glass ceiling. Only 2% of big corporations in the United States and 5 of those in the United Kingdom are run by women, but that's a major step toward breaking down these ancient barriers. I mean, it was only a century or so ago that women didn't have the same property rights that men did, and they didn't yet have the right to vote in the United States and most other countries. Swords into plowshares is just an interesting little fact. Weapons-grade uranium from decommissioned Soviet nuclear warheads, some 15,000 of which have been destroyed now, supply half the electricity being generated by U.S. nuclear plants. In addition to that, there, of course, is scientific knowledge itself. More has been learned in the past century or so than in all prior human history combined about the origin and age of the Earth, the origin of species, the evolution of life, the age and evolution of the universe, the anatomy and function of the brain, how stars shine, what matter and energy are made of, and 10,000 other things. If you had been a scientifically inclined member of one of the scientific clubs that formed in London in the 1600s, let's set the date at some day in 1700, and you met in a coffee house, say on Change Alley, which two of these scientific coffee houses were located, and you tried to predict what the world would be like in 300 years if science and liberalism were able to continue in a way that Bacon had vaguely glimpsed and in the century since people had been talking about more thoroughly, you might have guessed that these great achievements in knowledge would come about. You might even have guessed that many of these unjust barriers in society that oppressed so many kinds of people for reasons that had nothing to do with their own merit would be done away with. But if you had predicted that the life expectancy of people everywhere in the world would be more than doubled, that per capita income would increase by a factor of 10, that 80% of all adults in the whole world would know how to read and write, that you'd have anything like the educational levels that we now have in the liberal democratic countries of the world, that world peace would have progressed as far as it did, and there would be a country the size of the United States in which half the people had a household income, which the median household income was $100,000. That would have just seemed unbelievably optimistic. No one really would have believed that, not even people like Wren and Haley, who were great backers of science and liberalism. They would have thought that was too optimistic, and yet that is the world that we're living in today. Now, we also have some serious challenges to this ongoing enterprise, and I want to mention just three of them. Population growth has been a cause of concern for all sorts of enterprises. Ecological stress, in which I'll just talk for a moment about global warming, and the persistent popularity of dogma. Population growth. The growth rate of world population peaked in 1963 at 2.2%. So in 1963, there were 2.2% more people at the end of the year than the beginning. The growth rate is currently only 1.17%, and it's dropping. Now, this is very good news because, you know, if you look at a graph of human population, prior to the advent of science and liberalism, the population bubbled along at very low levels. Then it took off quite steeply. Now, whenever you see a curve like this in biology, a suddenly rising population curve, one of two things are going to happen. It's either going to level off at the top, which is called an S-curve, and you'll get a new stable population that's much larger, or it's going to immediately crash, which is an inverted U-curve. You see a lot of inverted U-curves in populational biology because typically what will happen is a species invades a new area, there's a lot to eat, there's not much competition, they proliferate rapidly, they eat up all the resources, and they crash through starvation or some similar disaster. Now, the predation is another one. And there were a lot of books published 20, 30, 40 years ago predicting just this unfortunate fate for humankind. But it now appears that this is going to be an S-curve, that our population is going to stabilize probably somewhere around 9 billion. And the reason for that is urbanization. For the first time in history, the majority of humans now live in cities. And they live in cities by choice for the same reason that people have all through history. When people have a chance to get off the farm and go to cities, they do it. And this happened in Europe hundreds of years ago. And it happened for the same reason it's happening now in the rest of the world, because advanced agricultural methods, determined primarily through experimentation, made the farms much more productive. That meant that you didn't have to have a lot of kids to help out on the farm, and they didn't all have to do farm work. The idea that farm work is wonderful for everybody is primarily a literary invention. It was invented by Virgil, as far as I can tell, who, unlike Hesiod, actually, Hesiod was quite interesting at farm work and did some. But Virgil, we remember for having said how wonderful it was to work on a farm, never worked a day in his life on a farm, and was then re-upped in just before the French Revolution, unfortunately, by Jean-Jacques Rousseau, literally a madman, who wrote a completely imaginary version of human history in which primitive man had had this wonderful life, always lots to eat, no need to worry about warfare, sexual jealousy, none of these problems. Everything was just peachy back in the old days, and everything had been ruined by civilization. This is one of the most pernicious ideas ever put down on paper by one of the most personally pernicious philosophers ever to afflict Western culture. It resulted in the terror in the French Revolution. It was a great inspiration to people like Adolf Hitler. Fortunately, it's not true. We know quite a bit now about how people used to live, and it wasn't like that. So once you've got decent enough roads that your strapping teenager who is not needed on the farm can has a reasonable chance of making it to the city without being robbed or killed by a highwayman, which had been the case for much of prior history, he's going to take off for the city, and that's what's now happening worldwide. The crossing point was back, I guess, about 2005 or 6, when the majority of the world tipped toward cities. Now, the results, of course, initially are not at all happy, because these folks showing up in the cities are not welcomed in. They don't find good jobs. Most of them live in hideous slums, and the megacities around the world are now ringed by these slums. And we've all seen photos in which you have the hideous slum in the foreground and gleaming skyscrapers in the background. And these photos are most often used to illustrate some complaint about capitalism or free trade. But I think that's a mistaken perception, because these slums existed in all the other cities back in previous history. I'll give you an example. London in the 16th century began to experience an influx of people from the farms for these reasons. And they were literally barred from the city. You weren't allowed in the city after dark without a permit, and the doors were closed to you, so there grew up these squalid shanty towns under the walls of London. The term suburbs was coined to mean under the city walls, suburb, and that's what these shanty towns were. They were great concern to the citizens of London, who commissioned various reports to study them and try to figure out what to do about them. A number of laws were passed by the sort of politician who doesn't need to see a report, doesn't need to know any empirical data, just somehow knows in his heart what's right. And so they passed a series of poor laws that said things like, you all have to go back home and register with the government, then wait your turn to be allowed to come back to London. Nobody bought that. But the studies were quite interesting, sort of early sociology. One of them was completed in 1588 by Lord Cecil, who reported to Queen Elizabeth I on the residents of a particular shanty town and observed that, quote, they excel in policy and industry and demonstrate a natural ardency of new inventions annexed to an unyielding industry. In other words, they were smart, they're hardworking, and they were willing to try new things. Now, you want those people in the city, but it's been the challenge to every city as to how to incorporate them as quickly and as fairly as possible. In London, the main problem were the guilds, which did not need competition. They didn't want a lot of young people with new ideas coming in and competing with the goldsmiths and so forth, because they were doing very well on their inflated profits and their tightly controlled licenses. So today we see the same situation. And by the way, a lot of what you read in Karl Marx is a reaction to the same sort of thing that occurred in for instance, the north of England. Marxists all used to tell a story about, I think it was Engels actually said that this happened to him. He was walking the streets of Manchester with what he described as a bourgeois, and he was complaining about the horrible conditions in Manchester, which they certainly were. Manchester had ingested an incredible number of people in a very short period of time and had no idea how to provide for them. So he had these terrible slums. Most of these folks had been poor when they were on the farm, too, by the way, but they've been conveniently out of the sight of sensitive intellectuals who now suddenly had to actually see them on the streets. So Engels complained about all this, and at the end, the bourgeois said, well, yes, that's true, but, you know, still there's a great deal of money to be made here, sir. And he bid him goodbye. Now, that story was always told by Marxists because the bourgeois was supposed to be the villain of the piece. But he was right. There was a lot of money to be made in Manchester, and a lot of people made it, and those slums didn't endure. They didn't endure in London either. There are no slums in those cities today at all by Dickensian standards, and the air in London is the cleanest it's been in 400 years. So what we're going through is not an unprecedented thing, and it's not an indictment of the way we got to where we are, in my opinion. Quickly, let me mention ecological stress, particularly global warming, because we seem to be going the wrong way on global warming. Fewer Americans today than just 2 years ago believe that the planet is getting warmer. It certainly is. Or that if it is, that human activity has anything to do with it. So let me mention that first, that the basic mechanism of global warming was identified and studied by many different scientists, often working independent of one another, dating back to the 18th century. This is not some new discovery. It was well over a century ago that scientists began to think, gee, you know, if we continue with this industrial activity, wouldn't we eventually warm up the planet? But industry was at such a low level at that time that it seemed a distant prospect. The phenomenon of global warming is scientifically robust. It's not model sensitive. You hear a lot of discussion about how the scientific models aren't perfect. Well, of course they're not perfect. They're models. The models are never perfect. The only perfect model of the world would be another Earth, and it would, in a matter of moments, cease to be a duplicate of this Earth. And finally, it's cheaper to avoid if you start working on it a little bit early than if you wait. You see a lot of this in science where you have initial conditions problems. An example is an asteroid that's discovered to be on a course that will one day bring it into impacting the Earth. So you want to move that asteroid a little bit out of its orbit. If you wait, like the movies do, until, you know, months, weeks, or days before the asteroid hits, you may find that you've exceeded your resources. You can't divert it any longer. But if you divert it 10 or 20 years in advance, it takes next to nothing. A little gentle rocket can just, all it has to do is move it a little bit, then you don't have the problem later on. My grandfather worked at the Harlan Wolff shipyards in Belfast, where they built the Titanic. Titanic was a good ship, but it was the biggest ship ever built, and its rudder was not as big in relative to the mass of the ship as had been the case with its immediate predecessors. Consequently, the highly experienced captain of the Titanic didn't realize that the methods he had always used, which were that you, in clear weather, you could cruise at top speed, just keep your lookout alert for icebergs. As soon as he spotted an iceberg, he would call it out. You would put in that initial course correction. That would get you around the iceberg. Didn't work. He did all that. He was going full speed. He got a proper call on a cold night, clear night, by his lookout. He inputted full I think it was right rudder, and hit the iceberg because the old methods weren't sufficient for this new condition. And so you can't just say that, you know, when you put a third of the CO2 in the atmosphere in there by human industry, you can't just say, well, it won't have any effect because we hadn't noticed all that much yet. It's been okay so far. That's a classic input problem. Fortunately, we also have a lot of resources to dedicate to it. If we start paying attention to it now and moving in the right direction now rather than waiting till later. The world spends $7 trillion on energy a year. It's a lot of money. The U.S. spends $500 billion annually just on foreign oil. And the total global energy use, currently about 15 terawatts, comes 87% from fossil fuels. So if you need to cut something, the fact that it's 87% is good news because it means you've got a lot of room to start steering in a more sensible direction. The current cost of curbing global warming emissions, it has been estimated at around 1% of global GDP. That's not lost. It's investment. You know, it's just like other kinds of spending. The future cost may grow steeply, and as I've said, can grow to the point that you overwhelm your resources. If that occurs, you're really cooked. You never want to get in a situation where the economy is collapsing, that curve's going down, and the curve of what you need has been going up, and you can no longer stop. And that can happen, by the way, because there are a lot of nonlinear effects that occur in global warming. And I'll give you an example from one that dates back just to March 4th. This was a release by the National Science Foundation. On March 4th, 2010, and I quote, "A section of the Arctic Ocean seafloor that holds vast stores of frozen methane is showing signs of instability and widespread venting. The permafrost under the East Siberian Arctic Shelf, long thought to be an impermeable barrier sealing in methane, is perforated and is starting to leak large amounts of methane into the atmosphere. Release of even a fraction of the methane stored in this shelf could trigger abrupt climate warming. Methane is a greenhouse gas more than 30 times more potent than carbon dioxide." Now, that's a nonlinear effect. If you start releasing methane, it didn't happen because you turned the CO2 or the other gases way up. You just reached the point where that started to occur. Suddenly, your problem can go up by a magnitude factor of 10 or more. So, anyway, that's a challenge to the future of science and liberalism and a whole lot of other things that we care about. Now, I will finally say a word about dogma, which is etymologically means a received opinion that seems good enough. We have today dogma from every quarter, and I think, most people, I know I'm in this category, arrive at their politics the way they arrive at their religious opinions. They're inherited from their parents and not much examined thereafter. And that's why a host of a dinner party will generally try to discourage talk of those two subjects, because the two subjects that you didn't really form your own opinion on, you inherited a view or a tribal affiliation as a child. Those who have not later examined their views or learned more or modified them tend to view politics as just a kind of tribal matter. You paint your face blue or orange, and you jump up and down, and you yell about the bad people over on the other side, and they do the same. And that's what a lot of politics consists of. And the folks who look at politics that way are trapped, really, by dogma. It's just the dogma that they were taught. They see the world in Manichaean terms, that they're good and this other side is evil, and everything that's bad in the world is bad because the evil side won't let them fix it. The whole purpose of writing a book like The Science of Liberty is to help folks move past that into a more empirical understanding of the world, to move into that cyclical view that I started out by describing, which you have an idea, you test it, and you modify it according to the results of that test. Dogma doesn't work like that. The engine of dogma goes, you have a theory, you don't experiment, and you affirm the theory no matter what. Somebody else doesn't affirm the theory and starts to give you trouble about it, you clap them in irons, you show them the instruments of torture, you confiscate their writings. That's dogma in action. There's still quite a lot of it in the world. Remember, that although a lot of people are now living in liberal democracies, it's still fewer than the majority of humanity. With liberal democracy as a realized form is still a minority condition. And science is even smaller. Even in a scientific powerhouse like the United States, the vast majority of Americans have no idea how science works, and consequently rather fear it. They see it as a machine that's powerful, but that works in ways they don't understand. So I would just say that the dogma tends to bifurcate the world, and that science has found that it's all one world. It didn't have to. Science could have, if the laws of physics were different in Connecticut than they are here in California, physics would have found that out. Turns out they're the same all through the universe. It's one universe. Scientific laws are universally applicable. All humans belong to one species. There's no empirical justification for racism, other discriminations. And all earthly life is kin, as the great poet Leadbelly put it. We're in the same boat, brother. You shake one end, you're going to rock the other. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Timothy Ferris. For the benefit of our radio audience, I want to remind us that we are listening to Timothy Ferris speaking to us about a very broad and interesting subject, generally the relationship between science and liberal democracies. Where it's now time that we can go to our audience questions. As I predicted, we have many, many questions, a fistful of questions. Very few contain dogma, you'll be happy to know. What I'm going to try to do is, to the extent there are overlapping questions, I'm going to consolidate them so we can cover as much as we can. First question, Tim. During the 30s and 40s, there was a great fear of the scientific expertise of Nazi Germany under a fascist regime. After the Second World War, we had the fear of the scientific expertise of communist Soviet Union. And those were both the type of societies that you would describe as not fostering science. Could you comment on that?
Yeah, this was one of the first issues that, of course, interested me when I started researching the science of liberty some 17 years ago now. Because if that impression were true, then my thesis would be false. If the widespread opinion that science is just a neutral tool, like an AK-47 that can be picked up off the battlefield and used by a soldier from either side, then I wouldn't have written this book. But it turns out not to be true. The Nazis were at pains. The Nazis, first of all, took power with 36% of the vote over a country that had a tradition for generations at that point of liberal reform, experiments with certain amounts of democracy, and had been doing well in science. And that carried forth somewhat through the years of the Nazi regime. But basically, the Nazis simply destroyed science in Germany, and all the empirical evidence makes this clear. The records are now pretty well established. I won't take time going through it all. But it was scientifically a disaster. The Soviet Union seemed was a kind of a different case because those on the left thought of the Soviets as more as being the opposite of the Nazis and so forth, which unfortunately is not the case. And the Soviets obligingly tried to project a sense that their scientific technological powerhouse was going to overcome that of the West. But there, too, it was a disaster. The one area where the Americans got nervous about was the launch of Sputnik and the Soviet space program, which had really very little to do with science. But as Nikita Khrushchev joked to an intimate member of his family about the Soviet space program, we have nothing to hide, we have nothing, and we must hide it.
While we're on the geopolitical theme, how would you compare the advancement of science under a governmental structure we see in China today?
Well, in the case of China, I have to make the unhappy prediction, because I have a great love for the Chinese people and hope that they will have the world-class scientific establishment that they deserve and are certainly capable of having. Chinese communists are spending a lot of money on trying to build up science and recruit Chinese nationals to come back and work at home. The thesis of the book predicts that this will not succeed so long as they have an illiberal government. They'll just get in the same situation that the Soviets had, where you try to create these little capsule cities of scientists where they're sort of allowed to act as if they were in liberal countries, and they get special privileges. But scientists resent that, as any intelligent people would. And they become your strongest source of dissidents. I mean, it's not a surprise that people like Fang Lijie, the great Chinese physicist who was convicted in absentia of fomenting the Tiananmen Square revolt, who had to take up residence in the American embassy in Beijing to avoid being imprisoned, and was dragged there by his friends and supporters against his own will, was spirited out to the U.S. and is now an astronomy professor at the University of Arizona, was among the leading Chinese dissidents, just as Sakharov was in the Soviet Union. You always find that dissidents in totalitarian countries are disproportionately likely to be scientists.
How does the combination of physical science and the political science that we'll call liberal democracy inform the science of economics?
Well, economics, despite its bad reputation, is a real science, and one that really has to be given credit for the well-being of hundreds of millions of people now. You know, it's easy to forget that. Let me quickly set aside a few myths, okay? One myth is that the current recession not only was not predicted by economists, but as one member of our government put it, could not have been predicted. This is a formulation, as far as I can tell, Condi Rice invented. Not only did no one predict it, but no one could have predicted it. That's utter nonsense. The collapse of the U.S. housing bubble was the subject of repeated articles in economics journals, including The Economist, which is a general interest news magazine, which warned year after year that this was going to happen. So the predictive power of economics is not as weak as people say it is. Neither, by the way, does the press not report all the stuff that it's said it doesn't report. I'm constantly having people say, I heard about this the other night, that the press didn't report the housing bubble. Well, you know, you can look it up yourself. There are hundreds of stories about it before it happened. What economics did was to produce immediate and measurable improvements in the lot of the poor. When Adam Smith published The Wealth of Nations, the government went to work as far as they could, politically could, trying to implement some of his principles. There was a movement to repeal the corn laws, which were protective barriers against import of corn. Within, I forget how many years it was after the 1776, it was on the order of a decade, those laws were repealed, and the price of food in England dropped sharply and immediately, just as it's dropped all over the world now for many decades, really centuries, ever since. One of the great revolutions in the world is that people can afford to feed themselves. That didn't used to be the case. And that's an accomplishment of economics, and it's one of many.
I remind our radio audience once again that you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California, and our guest today is noted science writer Timothy Farris, who is discussing the relationship between science and democracy in the modern world. Tim, to lighten up a bit, somebody asked that they had read that Locke and Newton were actually very good friends, and that seems quite an interesting coincidence.
Yeah, I talk about that in The Science of Liberty. John Locke was in exile in Holland. The British kept trying to extradite him so they could lock him up in the Tower of London for his seditious, although unpublished, writings, which were the basis of what we call liberalism today. The Dutch dutifully would search for John Locke, and to make sure that the search was thorough, they would go to each house that they're going to search a day or two in advance and say, the police are going to be coming here. Would Thursday afternoon work for you? And to see if Mr. Locke is here. And so he had escaped arrest and came back to England with the Glorious Revolution, and the first person he wanted to meet in England was Isaac Newton, who, in addition to having just published the Principia, was a radical Whig, meaning a liberal, one would say, who was a member of Parliament and wrote a number of papers setting out the legal basis on which ordinary people could challenge the unjustified authority of the Crown.
There are several questions that want to explore a little more your thesis that science and democracy are self-correcting systems. One of the concerns is that the infusion of large amounts of money into the political process could be considered a distortive factor in what might otherwise be a trial and error objective way to find out how we want to live our lives.
Yeah, it's a problem, all right. The huge amounts of money spent, I mean, money has been, you know, been called the mother's milk of American politics, so it's not a new problem, but the dimensions are much bigger than they used to be. And this dates back, as far as I could tell, to the advent of television. because paid political advertising for a while there was forming 70, 80, even 90% of some campaign budgets. It's down a bit now, but still a lot of money is spent on virtual marketing and the internet and so forth. To do that, to buy commercials and put them on television to put across your political view is illegal in virtually every liberal democracy except the United States. We can't make it illegal here because we have a Supreme Court decision that says we can't. So there is an experiment being operated to say, well, okay, is a system in which you have essentially you're free to spend unlimited amounts of money propagandizing on behalf of a candidate or a cause, is that better than limiting those expenditures? That experiment's running right now, and all you have to do is compare American politics and its outcome to that of other countries. And I don't know what the verdict of that will be. I'm not trying to load it up, but in fact, it's a social experiment that is observable.
Another concern about the self-correcting nature of the system is that many of the public policy questions that get worked out in democratic society require the understanding of science. And scientists are notorious for a need to be precise. And precision can get very easily lost in a public dialogue that requires most thoughts to be expressed in 30 seconds or less.
Well, and that's why it's not a good idea for nations to try to determine their science policy by referendum or by congressional debate, and that's not how we do it in this country. In this country, the government funds organizations like the National Science Foundation, the Centers for Disease Control, NEH, and tries to make a general determination of how they're doing and whether can we afford to continue to fund them at these levels. And generally, those levels have increased consistently despite the administration involved. Those organizations I mentioned, for instance, were receiving more federal money at the end of the George W. Bush presidency than they were at the beginning, despite the anti-scientific rhetoric sometimes that came out of that administration. So the process is that you hand over the decisions about how precisely to allocate the money to the scientists themselves, and they've done a pretty good job with that as far as I can tell. The NSF's considered an admirable organization around the world. And then you interface with those members of Congress who are particularly interested in or adept at science policy. It's not perfect, needless to say. Nothing in liberal democracy ever is. Liberal democracy is like a scientific laboratory. It's always a mess. It smells bad. There are loud noises. Things don't work out the way you expected. But somehow, in the long run, you get better results than from the other gleaming systems that had seemed so efficient.
Well, that leads into another question. Someone asks, why don't more scientists go into elected office? I mean, we just seems like it's lawyers and undertakers.
There are a few scientists in Congress, but not many. It's an interesting question, and I don't know specifically the answer. I would just say that science is still a new thing. You know, it's only about 400 years old. It hasn't been absorbed into the culture. The average person doesn't know what it is or how it works. And to ask them to accept a scientist as an elected official, sometimes they do. Sometimes they'll vote for that person. But it doesn't have the same cultural resonance for them that other sorts of people do. But that said, I'm veering close to underestimating the sophistication of voters, and I shouldn't do that. The American politics, for instance, for its whole history, you've always had charismatic religious figures who have been very popular, and some of them have been really good people and deserve to be really popular. But those who have tried to move over and run for office have not fared well because Americans just have a whole different mindset when it comes to who they're going to elect to office. So it's much easier to generalize about voters than it is to accurately predict who they're going to vote for.
Well, we have time for one more question, and it's an amalgamation of several questions that was handed, and it has to do with the influence of, I'll call it the internet, but the greater and greater access to information, because we can both find accurate information quite easily, but we can also come across inaccurate information and not have the capacity to know that it's inaccurate. So could you comment generally on, as we are in this so-called information age, how that plays into the symbiotic relationship between science and democracy?
Well, liberalism postulates that maximum information, with all of its flaws and inaccuracies, maximum availability of information is better than all the alternatives. So liberalism postulates that the Internet, in which anyone can publish anything, no matter how foolish or hateful it might be, is better than the more restricted things that preceded it. We'll see. You know, but there's always been lots of inaccuracies in books and articles, too. And one thing that, you know, they say is sunshine is healthy for curing infections. Some of the hideous dogmas of the past, like, you know, when the Nazis were starting to gain a foothold in Germany, for instance, at a time when, by the way, university professors were twice as likely to get on the bandwagon of the Nazi cause as the general population was, an interesting statistic to keep in mind. Part of the insidious appeal of documents like the Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion, an anti-Semitic tract, was that that you didn't see them in bookstores. These were pamphlets that were handed. You know, they say, well, the government won't allow you to see this, which pre-Hitler times is true. But, you know, this is the secret truth they don't want you to know. Now all these things are Internet links, so that the appeal of, you know, having access to something that's been hidden from you is largely lost. But it is an ongoing experiment. It'll be good to see what happens. But I would bet very strongly that the Internet is like, say, the Springfield rifle or the typewriter, a technology that's ultimately a friend to the free individual.
Well, thank you, Timothy Ferris, very much. And I am going to call this a session of the Commonwealth Club officially adjourned.
Thank you very much.